I have the pleasure of being joined today by Lars Fruergaard Jørgensen, CEO of Novo Nordisk. As most of you know, Novo Nordisk is a global healthcare company founded in Denmark in 1923 and headquarters just outside Copenhagen. And it is focused on chronic diseases, particularly diabetes and obesity. As it happens, I had the opportunity to work with Novo Nordisk between 1996 and 2000. And back then, it was a relatively small niche company. 25 years later, and in a nutshell, Novo Nordisk is the global leader in diabetes care and obesity care, global number three in hemophilia. It serves every year more than 40 million patients in 170 countries, employing currently 64,000 people around the world, generating revenues of over 30 billion euros and a market capitalization of over 500 billion euros, which makes Novo Nordisk the largest market capitalization in Europe and the 14th in the world as per last week's stock prices. Another way of describing Novo Nordisk's growth since 1996, revenues were multiplied by more than 15 and the stock price by more than 180. That's obviously an extraordinary success story, and I look forward to discussing it. Lars became the company's CEO in 2017. He had joined the company 26 years earlier in 1991 after graduating from Aarhus School of Business. Over the years, Lars has also sat on several boards of directors. He was also named in December 2023 the Financial Times Person of the Year, and he currently serves as the president of the European Federation of Pharmaceutical Industries and Association. Lars, thank you very much, A, for making the time to speak with me, but also for welcoming us in your offices here in Bagsværd.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming, and it was fascinating to listening to that story. It's a good reminder of how things change over many years, and I look forward to have this discussion.
Now, Lars, a big part of Novo Nordisk's extraordinary growth over the last few years has been the takeoff of second-generation GLP-1 therapies, as they're called. Is it possible for you, for non-specialists, to describe a little bit what's special about these therapies and how they differ from traditional therapies?
Yes, so what we do in Novo Nordisk is typically to work with, say, biology, different mechanisms that we all have ourselves and upregulate that, and that's also the case in GLP-1. So this is a natural, protein, peptide that all of us produce ourselves. And if you make an analog of that, modify a bit the molecular structure, you can actually, increase some of the benefits, and those are both linked to the whole, metabolism and also how you actually digest what you have eaten, but also work in the central nervous system, and in the case of obesity, is actually reducing your appetite, so you eat less, and we are exploring it a number of indications linked to those basic biologies. So it's a multifaceted approach in the body.
Am I correct that they also have some anti-inflammatory properties?
Yes, it's anti-inflammatory, and that's important in its way of reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease.
Right.
So when you have diabetes, for instance, you can build atherosclerotic impact on your whole cardiometabolic system, where your veins get stiffer, so to say. And this anti-inflammatory effect of GLP-1 actually reduces that, and that has led to an evidence of significantly reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease when you use these products.
And we'll come back to this.
Yeah.
But before we do, I want to spend a little bit of time on the previous 20 years of the company's history. When you succeeded your predecessor, Lars Rebien Sørensen, and became CEO in 2017, Novo had been going through a bit of a difficult time. Short period of time, insulin prices in the US had gone down, and of course, because at the time you were so focused on diabetes, Novo Nordisk stock suffered probably a little bit more than other companies. But prior to that, and through Lars Rebien's tenure, Novo Nordisk had done remarkably well in terms of revenues, profit, stock price. Why was Novo Nordisk so successful over these 20 years?
You need to operate in markets where there's a big demand, a large unaddressed market. So that's the case in diabetes and obesity. So picking spaces where you can grow is obviously important. But then also the focus, how you make sure you have capabilities that sets you up to do, say, distinct better than competition, that's really important. Because in our business, we play with really, really low odds at the get-go. So when we start a research program, it perhaps have around 5% likelihood of actually becoming a product that meets one of these unaddressed needs among patients. So how you optimize your odds of success throughout the value chain is really, really important. And you mentioned when Lars Rebien took over, and even his predecessor, Mats Olesen, right. They ran businesses that were broader. And over the years, we left businesses to become more and more focused. And almost every time we did that, we ended up strengthening the core. And that talks a bit to this notion of increasing your odds by really focusing on what you do distinct better right. than others. So we have a very, say, tight strategy map of what are the technologies we master in the company and how do we make sure we master them as good as or better than our competitors, because that improves the odds. And then we apply those technologies up against a set of disease areas where we also have very broad experience. We know the key opinion leaders, we know the prescribers.
Right.
So we can actually develop medicines to those physicians where there's an underlying big patient population behind. And every time we move within this map and go into a new disease area, it has to be an adjacent disease area, so we know something around it, we know some of the prescribers, or if we move on the technology side, we also need to do that in a very disciplined way, because no company was ever successful in going into a new disease area with a new technology.
So you're reminding us that strategy is about where to play and how to win, and you're saying over the years we've been very mindful and deliberate in deciding where to play. Now, one of the aspects is, of course, therapeutical areas. Another aspect is geography. My understanding is that during that period, one of the key decisions was to enter the US market in a relatively big way. And in fact, Novo was successful in going from a relatively small place in the US to a dominating position, essentially between 2000 and 2010. Please tell us a bit more about how you gained that position. It's not like there was no treatment prior to your arrival.
No, that's a key point, and it's a good reminder that I forgot to mention the geographies, because now we are a global company, and that is really, really important, because as I talk about odds and investments into disease areas, if you're not capable of extracting the value of that globally, you also play with lower odds of success, because right. it costs the same for all to develop the right. medicine, but if you cannot commercialize it to all globally, your return on that investment becomes lower, and that means you have less capital to deploy into to new research. So for us, being a Danish origin company, we as a company were strong in Europe, rest of the world, and Lilly all along strong in the US. So the fortune came to us in the form of one of our hemophilia products.
Right.
And it was a long journey getting it approved in the US. But finally, we got it approved to a rare disease, hemophilia, those patients who lived with inhibitors and could not use the classical products. And so it was a life-saving medicine. And that created an opportunity to grow in the US and actually invest significantly in making it. So that funded investment to a large sales force in the US. And then eventually we came in and got our fair share of the US market. And had we not succeeded in doing that, we would probably have partnered our US business.
Okay.
And Novo Nordisk would not be a global company as it is today. And we could not have seen the momentum we have today. And most likely not being in the US, which is half of the global pharmaceutical market, I would doubt we would be a standalone company today.
To what extent did your ownership structure help? So Novo Nordisk shares are publicly traded, but there is a philanthropic foundation that owns about 20 some percent of the shares, but has about, I think, 70% of the votes. To what extent has this been helpful during those 20 years?
It has been fundamental. Throughout my career, I've had different roles. For quite some years, I've been leading corporate development. And in that role, I had many companies coming to visit us to seek a partnership, i.e. acquire the company. And it was typically a short conversation because I could hand them an English translation of the bylaws of the foundation, where it says that their purpose is to own the company, right, and only if it's necessary for the survival of the company can they give up control. And that has not been the case so far. So they sit with, as you say, 27-28% of the shares. Those are A shares carrying 10 votes a share, and then the B shares are listed on the stock market. So we have the really, really long-term perspective from our controlling shareholder, the foundation, and then we have the day-to-day, say, discipline from the capital market. And I think that's a beautiful model for an industry where we have development cycles that are, you know, 20 years or so. And it's an industry where you know, there are different cycles. We just spoke about the insulin cycle that leveled out, and we had some time to then move on to the GLP-1 cycle. And by having that stable ownership, you can ride these waves in a stable way, and having a long-term perspective on how you generate value, really looking at the science and the therapy areas we serve.
So beyond the ownership aspect, one of the things that has struck me as I was researching for this discussion is Novo Nordisk's ability to innovate again and again and again. Now, you've mentioned focus as a key dimension of this ability to innovate. But beyond focus, the impression I have is that Novo Nordisk has developed a very special culture, a very innovative culture, which, if I go back to the Novo Nordisk lore, includes people at lower levels pushing back on management and getting things accepted. So tell us a little bit about the Novo Nordisk innovation culture.
Yeah, it's maybe you should actually ask one of the, you know, researchers, because I might see it slightly different. But I think it being a Danish company, or say a company with some Danish Scandinavian values, I think the power distance is very low, which means that from time to time I have researchers knocking on my door to share their passion and tell me what they believe in. And that helps me build a perspective on what we should be doing. And it's always about the science. You cannot put research on formula. You can do business cases, you can do strategies, and you can assess what is the market opportunity, how many patients are there, and you can perhaps segment it into sub-patient groups. But if you then start to direct science too heavily, most likely you'll get blinded.
Okay.
And typically science shows its face in different ways. So I believe a lot in actually letting the scientists try to unlock the value, get into some early clinical testing, and then see how it works. And then we can connect it with some of the commercial opportunities. But if you put it too much on formula, I think it becomes too much of a top-down directed strategy. We should talk about where we play and how we want to win. But then you have to let science speak its own language and look at the data and then be driven by that. In the area of GLP-1s, there's been a large number of companies who actually developed the GLP-1, but most of them were not really succeeding because they were not differentiated. And when we developed our second generation GLP-1, it was not just the next one in line, it's actually one out maybe 200 different analogs that had been modified using our core capabilities for the optimal pharmaceutical benefit. And then we picked that one and brought it forward. And I think Lilly has some of the same capabilities. So these capabilities, the scientific mindset, and how you let scientists both be directed by a strategy, but giving them the independence to actually do what they believe in is a subtle choice.
And here I'm also hearing also the ability to have a long-term focus, which we already discussed before. Is it also fair to say that Novo Nordisk is a very purpose-driven company with very clear values, openness, accountability and respect, and a Novo Nordisk way, which includes also principles that include never compromise on quality and ethics? Tell us a little bit more about this Novo Nordisk way.
So it's you can say many companies have a set of values, and so do we, but they actually go 100 years back and have lived throughout that period of time. And we do a lot of training of leaders. We evaluate leaders on it. We promote leaders based on it. So I think it's a strength today. I would say close to a competitive edge. And when we recruit people, now I've only worked for one company in Novo Nordisk. When we recruit people and I have an opportunity of meeting them after some time, I always ask them about, so how do you feel about being in Novo Nordisk? And typically, they start talking about something that's about the culture that is being lived, the integrity, whereby we show these values in an everyday manner, which makes me really, really proud and underlines the importance of really, walking the talk from the top on these key aspects.
Do you remember one or two moments where either you or somebody made a decision that was really an important one and that gave a very strong signal on the importance? Because many companies also say we want to have a high quality, patient-centric, people-centric, but very few succeed. So you've already said we recruit, we promote, we train.
But we also dismiss. So I would say both in terms of product development, there's been cases where we simply terminated the development program because we were worried about some safety aspects. And if you each and every time say, okay, we are a patient-centric company, then if there's the slightest doubt about safety, we don't go there. And that makes it easier to make difficult decisions. Right. Same on product quality. If you have the slightest doubt about whether a product was produced in compliance, of course you have to investigate it. But if it turns out that this batch is problematic, well, then local leaders can find guidance in the Nordisk way that we never compromise on quality. So you scrap it. And the same goes for people. When you recruit people, obviously you look for people who express a preference for that type of values, because if it's a leader, it will become more natural for that person to lead that way. But it also means that if you come across leaders who do not show that consistently, many can do the right thing because, you know, you can read the values and you can, you know, play it the right way. But if you don't fundamentally believe in it, you will probably be in situations where you are not living the values.
Right.
And we have ways to detect that. And there's also a speak up culture. And it's found that even, you know, senior leaders are not doing the right thing, that you cannot stay in the company despite very strong business performance.
Thank you for this. That was very helpful. Maybe one last question on this before we move to today. One of the major decisions that was made during those 20 years was indeed to start studying the potential benefits of GLP-1 agonists in the fight against obesity. At the time, and still to some extent today, but certainly at the time, many companies and most observers were looking at obesity as a willpower issue as opposed to a complex pathology. Novo Nordisk, I think, initiated its first clinical trial in this area in 2001, I think. Tell us a little bit more about why the company decided, in fact, we're thinking about it differently and let's see if this works.
Yeah, so at that point of time, there was no real obesity market. So you can say, we spoke about before that there needs to be large addressable markets.
Right.
There was not really a market. And many of the products that had been launched had not succeeded or had been withdrawn from the market because it turned out to have unintended negative side effects.
Right.
So you can say it was a depressing outlook in a way, but we had seen some clinical data that led people to lose weight. And we felt that, okay, if that's the case, there'll be usage of these medicines in weight loss. And that's a bit unethical of us not having studied it. Because if we know one of our products is going to be used in a patient population, we need to make sure that we have studied it, not least in a therapy area where there has been safety issues in the past.
Right.
So we actually owe those patients to have studied it. And then, of course, the upside of being a market, because we also knew that there's a link between overweight and type 2 diabetes,
sure.
And type 2 diabetes being our biggest market, so there's also a way to prevent that. So that led us to do it, but it was not a straightforward, say, choice, because we're worried about actually damaging our diabetes business, because
right.
If we did this development and it did in fact turn out that there were safety issues, then it could destroy the whole category.
Okay.
So I remember the CEO back then, Lars Raben, leaning in and saying that if we have products that will be used in a segment, we have to study it. So that was one of the examples where a CEO can do certain things that the rest of the company can not.
Right.
Lean in and make decisions based on values. And this was, you know, both a business opportunity, but also linking to this this essential saying that we are patient-centric.
Let's focus on today's challenges and opportunities. First challenge and opportunity that comes to mind is an extraordinary ramp up of capacity. And of course, the world is hoping that you can ramp up capacity as fast as possible, but also as slowly as necessary, right? Because this is pharma and there are clearly quality and regulatory and compliance issues that you need to take into account. So please tell us about first the physical side of the expansion. What's needed? How fast can you go? And what percentage of the market can you ultimately handle by yourself?
Yeah, so we today serve maybe 1 or 2 million people living with obesity, and some forecasts say that there's a billion, depending a bit on is it today or in a few years, but it's a huge market. We know from diabetes that many are not diagnosed,
right.
Many do not get treatment. The dynamics around obesity is a bit different because most are aware. And so we see a huge urge for being on treatment. And it's interesting, back to our discussion about when did we start development, that we were biased by our own experience with the first generation product that delivered a lower weight loss, not really enough to really make patients excited and physicians excited. So we had not seen this growth coming. So when we launched the second generation product, delivering significantly more than 10%, which is probably the threshold for patients and physicians to be excited, we saw this steep uptake. And then we had to get going on building more capacity. It takes for the core ingredient, the so-called API, active pharmaceutical ingredient, it takes perhaps 5 years to build such a factory. So you think about it, takes maybe a year to prepare such a project. You have to have it approved, and then it's ready 5 years later. So right now we are building a number of such API factories. And after you have produced the API, you need to do fill finish. So it's sterile liquid products going into a glass container and into a device. Such a factory also takes another, say, 4 years to build. So massive CapEx program, and we don't really comment on how many patients we believe we can serve, because that's highly confidential. But even that program will only be a fraction of the total addressable market. So typically, after we build these factories, comes a lot of optimizations. We improve throughput, so we can drive up yields. So. You mentioned the 40 million patients we serve today. We grew that by 5 million in 1 year. So if you can, you know, imagine if we in the coming years can add another 5 million year over year, that's going to be a large number of patients we can serve.
Expansion possibilities are almost infinite.
They are, because if you have a disease area where the patient population is a sizable part of the total world. And perhaps that trend will continue, so it will be an even larger share of the world population. That's exciting from a business point of view, right. But obviously also from a health point of view, because obesity is a gateway to through to a number of other diseases. So if we can prevent those, that's a very meaningful thing to do.
Now, there's also a human side to the expansion. Over the last, I think, 2 years, you've added 20% of new employees, which is quite significant. How do you go about ensuring that they absorb and internalize this Novo Nordisk way that we discussed a minute ago?
Yeah, that's a key challenge. And many of them have been recruited in Denmark because as we ramp up manufacturing and we have a significant footprint in Denmark, many of those jobs are created here. And although Denmark is a beautiful country, it's not the biggest country. So we are actually sourcing in a relative limited, employee pool. And also when you recruit that amount of people, obviously you rely on existing colleagues to educate right. and train those patients. So day one, it takes out capacity.
And so clearly you're saying it's not just the hiring, which is hard enough, it's also the induction and the acclimatization in the culture.
Exactly. And you could say if we in this growth phase, destroyed the culture because we didn't onboard all the newcomers, that would be terrible. Because I just mentioned that I believe the Novo Nordisk way is part of our competitive edge. It's what makes people want to work here. It's what sets researchers free. It's what makes, innovation thrive. And if we then in the growth phase onboard so many new people that the consistency, the core of having the values lift right. is not strong, then we have destroyed the company for right. the future. And if you get, if you don't have, a consistent and high integrity in how we live the values, people become cynical because management talk about values, but they're not being lived.
Of course.
So people lose trust in it, and then you have lost it. So this is really, really important that we double down on that. And I actually think that if you recruit the right people who are decent, people, they want to onboard such a culture, and you can do that quickly. But if you don't have that, core, it's really, really difficult to establish in the company because it just takes a few bad actors
right.
and the consistency is lost and people don't really dare to trust the culture. So I think we have a strong core. I think when you recruit, good people, they can quickly onboard it. So we have to look out for the few people who didn't get it right and make sure that they get training, a fair chance to make it, and if they cannot make it, they can work somewhere else.
Now, GLP-1 agonists, clearly second generation, diabetes, obesity, but also increasingly clinical trials are showing that they can help with cardiovascular diseases, they can help with kidney diseases. Some potential, maybe even that it might help for Alzheimer's disease somewhere down the road. This sounds like a significant expansion of your focus, which until now had been quite disciplined. How do you approach this abundance of opportunities and how do you decide where to invest, how much and how?
Yeah, that's one of the key strategic choices we have to make as a company. And it talks a bit to the GLP-1 biology that it's not just one biology, it touches a number of biologies in the body, so it leads to different organs will have benefits, and you mentioned a number of those. And you can say it's a matter of what's the overlap among prescribers, business models, as a company, how many of those can we support? Obesity, we believe, is a near adjacency to diabetes. We can handle that ourselves. We believe it will be primary care, some of the same physicians who also treat people living with diabetes. When you get into cardiovascular disease, it's cardiologists. That's a different universe.
Right.
But we believe we can also address those. It's less specialist than it's... diabetes, obesity prescribers, so we can build capacity to do that. And GLP-1 led us in there. And then we actually managed to, via in-house research and also business development, build a quite broad cardiovascular franchise. So it's one of having a molecule that works in more therapeutic areas.
Right.
So from a technology point of view, you have one technology, but you then apply it on different disease areas.
Right. So it's existing capability, different markets.
And then you go in there, and then you start expanding from there. So it's a very, say,
adjacency.
It's adjacency that so that there's a reason why you play there.
Right.
And then you build a stronger. So you get a bridgehead in, and then you build a stronger presence. Alzheimer's is different. You can say a bit like obesity. It's a disease area where there's not been really good treatment. There are now coming treatment options. There are other companies trying to make it there. So we'll see how our data look like. There's probably going to be a synergistic effect between our molecule and what competition has, which are non-GLP-1 based treatments. So depending on how that plays out, we can make a choice to compete in different ways, either tackle on other companies or go in on our own. It can also be a separate brand or the same brand. So it depends a bit on how the market evolves and how we want to go there. It's not likely that we'll be building a lot of Alzheimer's research around it. So in that sense, it's different from cardiovascular disease. So we have a quite,
But it sounds like you're quite deliberate about it.
And
quite focused.
Yeah.
Yet another challenge that you're facing, on the positive side, of course, the ramping up, is the growing public pressure on and around the price of some of these treatments and the profits that are generated this way. For example, there's an American left-wing politician who recently called on greedy Novo to lower the price of one of these drugs. And I know that you think quite carefully and you care deeply about the impact of your actions on the healthcare systems. How are you dealing with these concerns?
Yeah, so of course, you can look at it at an industry level that we invest in R&D and all of that, but you can also look at it at a patient level, or you can look at it at a healthcare system level. If you look at the pricing we have today on our GLP-1 products, that's the same price point for the second generation product, which is much more efficacious compared to the first generation product. So we had a first generation, it was priced at a price point that was accepted in the market, and that drove strong uptake. Then we invest further in the second generation product, which is significantly better, and now replacing the other, and it's launched at the same price point. So we launched at existing price point, so to say.
And so that was already a sign of goodwill on your part.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we have proven that it's not only about regulating glucose level in type 2 diabetes, it's also about protecting from cardiovascular disease and now also kidney disease. The same we're showing in obesity, that it's cardioprotective. We're trying to show that it also works on fatty liver and we spoke about Alzheimer's, etc. So I think the value case is becoming stronger. So the price per patient, I believe, is becoming fairer and fairer. So I think what is challenging the healthcare systems is the number of patients.
Okay.
So over these years, we've seen that the number of patients eligible for being on treatment has just expanded a lot, and that has driven to a bigger cost burden for the healthcare systems. And healthcare systems are typically struggling in the sense that they have yearly budgets.
Right.
So if you go on these treatments and you prevent longer term complications,
right,
prevent ending up in hospital with a stroke, that is value that comes down the road. But for the healthcare system, the cost is upfront. So we need to figure out how can we deal with this in smarter ways? How can we better articulate that value? We did a large study of the cardiovascular protection in people living with obesity that showed that there's significant reduced hospitalization. There's a reduction in people developing type 2 diabetes by 3/4. Cardiovascular disease is reduced, etc. So when you start pricing that in and acknowledge that 80% of cost in healthcare systems today are caused by chronic diseases.
Right.
And obesity is a leading cause of many of these diseases. You're actually preventing a good part of those 80% of the total cost by going on treatment with our medicines. But healthcare systems doesn't look at cost like that. If you look at the educational sector, you're part of that sector. So we believe in investing in schooling of our children because there's a return on that. But in the healthcare sector, there's no dynamic effect of spending money, because many healthcare systems are designed for acute care.
Right.
You are hit by a car, you go into hospital, they fix it, and you're out.
Not for chronic care.
Not for chronic care. So we have not succeeded in actually explaining the value of doing this chronic care intervention, which is to a good degree actually preventing comorbidities. And had you not started a patient on treatment, within years the healthcare system would be picking cost up for type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, fatty liver and others, which is way more expensive.
But the reality is governments are functioning the way they are, right? And I know that actually you've been making proposals in this respect, I think, in saying, look, if you want to pay us later, it's okay too. Can you tell us a little bit what you've been proposing?
Yeah, I think we should look at ways where we can share the risk, so to say. We believe in our products, that they can prevent these comorbidities and thereby also forgo cost in the healthcare system.
Right.
So we would be willing to transact in a way where a healthcare system that would factor in that dynamic effect, we could actually, because we expect to be in business forever.
Right.
So a bit like an insurance company, that you can actually take a risk,
Be paid later.
And be paid later. And we can also have, say, other types of contracts where you say, okay, we price a product for a certain population where you have really high benefit, and if it turns out to be used in a wider population, then there is a lower cost because you have a lower benefit in theirs.
So these discussions are underway.
They are ongoing, and if you take obesity, there'll be no market where a healthcare system can actually reimburse for all people living with obesity.
Right.
So here we also increasingly launching in ways where we have both an out-of-pocket segment where those who can pay, they pay themselves, but the most vulnerable patients, those living in socioeconomic settings where they would not be able to afford, we actually make contracts with the healthcare system to make sure that they can cater for those patients. So if you take...
And those would pay less?
They would pay less.
Okay.
So we are open for different models. But of course, in the case of obesity, it starts with that you actually acknowledge that obesity is something that takes treatment. And there are also some healthcare systems that are still trying to get their head around.
Right.
What is obesity? Is it something we treat or not? And in the meantime, like in Denmark, where there's no reimbursement from the healthcare system, it's paid out of pocket to a degree where it's now around, say, 1.5% of the Danish population who has been on our second-generation obesity medicine. So that tells me that there's actually a price point that makes sense for the individual.
For these individuals.
But of course, many cannot afford it, and that's where the healthcare system should be there for them.
As you know, I'm a leadership professor. I have to ask you a few questions related to your own personal leadership journey. You've worked at Novo Nordisk your entire career, and you succeeded two leaders, Mads Olufsen and Lars Rebien Sørensen, who were legends in their own time and still are. You also took an organization that had a bit of short-term challenges, but fundamentally had been very successful for 20 years. How did you balance the need to respect and honor the past, to nurture the best aspects of today, while at the same time introducing enough change to steer the organization toward a brighter future?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's also one where I think it's clear that we all learn on the way. And if I got a second shot at doing exactly the same, I would perhaps have gone a bit faster on certain elements. So I was sitting in the executive team, and I stepped up and became the boss of
your peers, okay.
And it was at a time where the company was facing some headwinds. And I think we are all different. My approach is to earn the right to be the leader. So I think the first year or so, I I tried to make some changes, but I don't think I succeeded in actually doing it forcefully enough. But as time came by and I felt I was more established as a leader, I think the team also learned that when I actually have reflected on certain strategic things that we need to do, I'm actually quite
determined
in okay. making it happen. So some of the choice we have made over time, both from, I'd say, a leadership point of view, what are some of the leadership traits we need to instill in leaders right now, linked to where the company is, I have become much stronger on, and being also much more determined in how do we actually drive that change and roll it out. And also some of this, you know, core strategic choice, what we do with our portfolio, how we invest, I have also become more, say, determined in what that entails. But of course, it's a team process, and how we spend time in the team, both really becoming a team. We have invested a lot in getting to know each other. What are my self-limiting beliefs? How do I show up as a leader when under pressure? What are my, say, bad behaviors linked to my self-limiting beliefs? And the same for all. So when you get to know your colleagues in the leadership team in a way where on a bad day they show a certain behavior and you understand why do they do that,
right,
then you can become a really, really strong team where you compensate each other.
And complement one another.
One another. And that makes it much easier to make some of these core strategic choices where inherently big strategic choices are uncomfortable. Because had you known all the facts, you wouldn't be discussing it. So,
right.
So there's some ambiguity to it. And that's quite different whether you are, say, a risk lover or risk adverse. But having both in the team actually means that you can balance these personal preferences in a way that leads to a robust discussion, analysis, yet a decision being made. And I'm the conductor of that. And I have my views, but everyone in the team plays a key role in getting to that conclusion.
And so one of the aspects that you're emphasizing is the importance of alignment within the top team, because it's not only we make the decision, but then this decision is going to be implemented and driven through the organization.
Yeah.
Hypothetical situation. You and I studied together at Harvard Business School 30 some years ago. We lost track of one another, and recently at an alumni meeting, we found one another again. What remains from the young Lars Fruergaard Jørgensen, and what has changed?
I think what remains is that we would still have been in contact, because I'm still in contact with a lot of my friends. We have a small, say, club where we meet at his Eva's house on change for
okay.
dinner. It used to be every Wednesday, then we got family, so it's less frequent now, but we still get together, and it's like back in school when we then get together. What has changed, I think, would be that I would be comfortable following my gut feel faster than I was back then.
Okay.
So I'm a sensor. I have an intuition for what works, what doesn't work. I still look at facts, but I'm very much driven by my gut feel. But I trust my gut feel much more today than I did back then. And that's really handy as a CEO, because as we spoke about, there's a lot of ambiguity. You don't have all the facts, yet you're the one that needs to make a decision. And when you've had the discussion around the table, people will be looking at you. And if you're still struggling getting your head around all the facts and there's no contact to your gut feel, then it's really difficult.
So you've educated your judgment over the years and you trust it more today.
Yeah.
Did we know at the time when we were in school together 30 years ago that you would be CEO of the largest market capitalization in Europe?
No way. No way.
You weren't voted most likely to succeed.
So I did well in school, but I was, I was not, in any way the best. So I think I'm lucky. I joined a company that has been successful. I joined a company with some values that are close to my values. I'm born with big ears and a big nose. I'm good at sensing and smelling what goes on around. I think I have a mix of intelligence. I can study a topic and get a good feel for it, but I'm also good at reading people and meet with stakeholders, and listening skills are really, really important. And there are so many smart people working in Novo Nordisk that I have so far not come across a problem we couldn't solve ourselves by really listening to those who know the subject really, really well. And when you combine these aspects, you typically have a solution. But if you get too confident, too much into yourself, and you stop listening, then you only rely on your own gut feel, and that's too little. So this blend of listening and trusting your instincts.
Have you had to work at this to make sure that you continue to listen as you get increasingly celebrated as FT Person of the Year? It's you're getting a lot of positive reinforcement from the world. Is this something that you have to watch to make sure that you remain grounded?
Yeah, I think it's really, really important. I'm a person that is often in doubt. So I think the doubt creates this curiosity that will make me keep listening. But it's really, really important to understand that you're carrying a title, you have a role for some time. It's not about you, it's about the job. And if you work in a successful company, many will think that, okay, that's actually Lars, but it is the company and it is the team. I'm just playing my small role. And one day I'll be handing over the baton to somebody else, hopefully many years from now. And just like Lars Rebien at Mads Joelsen made sure that there were good, say, eggs in the basket.
Right.
When they took over, I find it as my and my team's biggest responsibility to make sure that we are now making the investments that 10 years from now will make the next team very successful. So in the big scheme of things, you just play a really, really small role, and you pass that role on to somebody else.
Last question. You just mentioned, I will pass on the baton to somebody else, hopefully in quite a few years. That means you're enjoying what you're doing. You love your job because?
I would say in marketing, you have the four P's. I would say I have three P's. It's the people in the company. And I know many of them. Obviously, many have been recruited over the years. But I still meet people I worked with 20, 30 years ago. So when I go and visit affiliates, it can be really emotional for me to meet all these people and sense their excitement about working for Novo Nordisk, our culture. So that makes me really, really proud. Then I think it's the patients. When you have the opportunity of meeting a patient and that patient tells you with gratitude what we're doing for them. When I go and visit a physician to have a discussion about our products, and you sit in the waiting room and somebody figure out that you come from Novo Nordisk and say that, okay, I'm using your product, I'd just like to thank you for what you do. I also get really emotional, I start to blossom now. And then, of course, our products, and that's what our scientists have delivered.
People, patients, products.
Yeah, I care a lot about what I do, and I'm a bit of a perfectionist at times. So I really, the integrity and the quality in the people, in the products, and what we do for patients really, really matters. So that is a pleasure to wake up every morning, get out of bed, and do something that's so meaningful. And I wish everyone would have that opportunity because it's wonderful.
This pleasure and this passion is quite communicative. I feel it. And I thank you very much for your time. And of course, I wish you continued success.
Thank you.